It's a sunny Saturday in early August. I meet Bob Chamberlain, the NDP's candidate, as he walks off the Gabriel Island ferry.
Hi, Mr. Chamberlain. How are you doing? I'm well, I'm Todd Maffin. Nice to meet you. Thanks for doing this.
He, his campaign manager, and his partner had been over there shaking hands.
So I'm going to leave you.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Have a good time.
Okay, thanks.
Good luck, everything.
We walk around the Cameron Island seawall and find a spot. I should mention it was quite a windy day and it was a little loud, so you will hear other people and seaplanes in the background. And I started by asking him about his parents.
My mom was Stella. Her maiden name is Smith, First Nations woman from Guilford Island, the Kwekwasutinuk. My dad was not First Nations. I've come up with the term Second Nations, but I realize that might not be the best way to say it either.
Perhaps historically accurate, but a little inciting.
For this location, yes. Yeah, for sure. But, you know,
how did they meet?
At the residential school. Mom was there up at St. Mike's Residential School in Lurk Bay, where many of our people went, sadly.
Yeah.
And my dad, his father, asked him to move along when he was 16. Nice way of saying he got thrown out. And so what I understand, I've never really gotten clear on what it was that brought Ray up to Alert Bay, but he wound up there. And he met my mom.
How old were they?
Oh God, they were quite young, 18, maybe younger, 18, 19,
yeah.
Somewhere's in there. But they got married, and which was quite a, kind of a rarity a bit, you know, for a First Nation woman to marry a non-native. And mom moved away from the family, and there was some tension there about marrying a non-native. We lived in logging camps. My dad was a truck driver. We wound up living in the Lower Mainland. He was driving for a milk company. And then we moved to Cobble Hill, which was fun. I mean, Cobble Hill was grade one to the beginning of grade four for me.
So it was just you and your mom and dad?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
I have my older brother, Herb, and my younger sisters, who are twins, Debbie and Ann. But then we wound up moving over to the Lower Mainland, truck driving, brought my dad there. And then to Cobble Hill. My dad was working with Domans then.
How old were you when you moved to Cobble Hill?
Cobble Hill, I was beginning grade one.
Were there a lot of First Nations kids in Cobble Hill at the time?
No, there wasn't. We were it.
Did you notice that difference?
Yeah. I did because it was where I first played soccer, and there was a couple other boys on the team that were First Nations, so it was pretty obvious that we were unique in terms of the population of the team. But there was no other First Nations in our community, in our neighborhood. But kids being kids, we just all got along, played road hockey and soccer and so on. But after we left Cobble Hill, it was about halfway through grade four, I guess, and we moved to Nanaimo. And so we moved. We were living in Ed's mobile home trailer park.
Do you know why you moved from Nanaimo?
Moved to Nanaimo because Dad got a job. I'm not exactly sure why he left Domans, but when he moved here, he was working for Dempster Charter Service, a really nice man named Mike Dempster. And so he drove Foremost Milk up and down the island. And I moved here grade four, went to Park Avenue Elementary School, got involved in sports, hockey. That was a lot of fun. Played 5 years in goal. And the funny thing was, I thought I was going to be a goal scorer. And then when we got to the very first game, the goalie wasn't there. And then the only guy I knew on the team is a guy named John Birchtold, and I was in elementary with him. And so he piped up and said, well, Bob plays goal and floor hockey at school. And next, you know, I'm strapping on the pads, and I became the goalie.
For how long?
Well, that was 5 years. That wasn't my dream, right? I didn't want to be a goalie. So, yeah, so here in Nanaimo, went to, you know, like I said, Park Avenue, went with John Barsby. And, you know, pretty vanilla life, you know. Dad was driving truck. Well, we really didn't see him much. I mean, when a man gets up at 3:30 to go to work, he goes to bed fairly early. And so with school and so on, there was not a lot of interaction with him throughout our lifetime. I had a friend of mine in a 12-step program. I was talking to him about some of my thoughts around my father. And he looked at me and he said, was there a roof over your head, food on the table, and clothes on your back? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, he did his job. And he said, it would be really unfair to take today's standards of parenting and paste it back on him in that era. And it was a bit of cold water on the face, but I thought, you know, my friend really cared and he was honest. And so it helped me reshape my views of what happened with my father. remember he called us all together in the living room, and he sat leaning against the stereo, so he was almost sitting on top of the amp, and I thought, wow, something's really serious if he's sitting on the amp. He just said, I just want you all to know that I'm moving out, and we're going to be getting a divorce. And not very few moments after that, he walked out the door.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really emotional. You know, I look back on it and what my mom went through. First moving away from her family, marrying a non-native person. There's a certain bit of being, I wouldn't say ostracized, but certainly there was a portion of set aside. And then moving with my father to various places like logging camps and Gibson's and Burnaby and Cobble Hill and now Nanaimo, where certainly we had family that lived in some of those places, but by and large, she was removed from her people and her family. Mm-hmm. And so for my father to make that decision and just go, it was a gut wrench for everybody. I mean, it was tough.
Do you know why he did that?
I've never really asked him. You know, like, he's 73 now. And
does he live locally?
Yeah, he lives here in Nanaimo.
Oh, he does?
Yeah, he lives up by Woodgrove Mall. But I just thought, well, he's 72, 73 now. What is there to gain by, digging deep into the past? I mean, his life has been what it is. I've been an adult for quite a few years now, and I can't paste my life experience on what my dad did or didn't do.
Do you have a good relationship with him right now, or any relationship?
No, I couldn't say that, no. When I received the vetting back from the NDP and knew I was going to be a candidate, I phoned him to let him know. Hey, Dad, just so you know, you're going to see my signs popping up around town. He goes, well, you don't have my vote. Because I remember when he was a very staunch NDP person. Hmm. But as he aged, he's now become very right-wing.
So your dad leaves.
Yep.
How did your mom handle that?
Well, it didn't go well.
Yeah.
My mom, she carried a lot of hurt. And so there was the choices she made weren't the best. Drinking. And so there I was at 12 years old, and, for all intents and purposes, cut free to the world. No real parental supervision. And, I look back on that now, and I'm not too surprised with the choices that came after that. I pursued what I saw. So I began drinking when I was 12 years old. And it was to excess right away. And so we lost the house, moved into a rental. That didn't work out. We wound up living in the Terminal Hotel for about a year. And that was...
How old were you at that time?
I was, 15? I remember feeling a lot of shame about living there. And more with the people I was in high school with. I didn't want them to know that I was living essentially in the skid bar, right? But we were there, my brother, myself, my mom, and my two sisters. But, later in life when I talked to my mom, I didn't realize this, but it was a year before my mom passed away. We were at one of my son's, softball games. So we were having a long conversation. And I explained to her, there's nothing about my life I would change. Because all of those experiences, good, bad, or otherwise, are what shaped me to be who I am today. And I'm really happy with who I am today. And I specifically spoke about the Terminal Hotel experience. And in our language, Kwakwala, we have a word, klumka. And to be klumka is when you have your nose in the air and you think you're better than people. And so when I spoke to my mom, I used that word and I said, that experience, that year at the terminal taught me not to be klumka. I met some amazingly wonderful people that lived in the terminal in the Queens. And, I think people might be surprised to know that. But what I found, and the way I look back on it now, are some really amazing people. Life threw them a curveball. They swung hard, missed, and they landed in a place like that. What I find quite fascinating, there used to be an arcade downtown between the terminal and the Queens, and there was, I guess, about 15 of us. And I, looking back, I always thought about us. We were the 15 kids that, fell through the cracks. And so we were, again, I saw a T-shirt that captures it well. It says, in my defense, I was left unsupervised, right? And, I just laughed when I saw that. I thought, that sums it up, because we were all cut free. I mean, there was no parental supervision. There was no oversight. We were just on our own. But what I find fascinating, though, three of us from that group wound up in First Nation leadership. What's now MCFD figured out where those four kids were living. And so we were placed back with our father, which wasn't all that great. He sent my younger sisters over to his sisters, my Auntie Kathy and Uncle Bruce and Gibson's. And the intention was to try and whip the boys into shape while the girls were staying with his sister. Of course, by 16, I'd been drinking for 4 years and very good at it. All right, so it didn't go well.
I'll bet.
And I think it was just before I turned 17, or no, it was shortly after 17, is I came in one morning about 3 in the morning, and he just said, I think it's time you find somewhere else to live. I didn't realize it as a cycle then, but I do now. I wound up on the streets of Vancouver for about 10 months out of that.
And still then, drinking?
Oh, yeah. I met a young lady about my age, and I asked my friend that I was on there with, I said, she's not a prostitute, is she? And he said to me, not yet. Mm. And that answer really resonated with me. I thought, not yet. So I thought there was some finality or destination for people on the streets there. And then this other guy that was in our broader circle, he was quite frantic one day, and because what is now MCFD had taken his runaway. And I remember he was quite frantic, and he talked about how much money he'd invested in her. And now the government ministry was going to take her back to her family. And so those two events happened very close to each other, and I realized the destination of that world I was running in and the predatory nature. And I thought, this is not me. And so instead of staying there, I hitchhiked up the Campbell River where my mom was living by then. And moved in with Manti Mary and settled into the Canberra River life. And that's when I started playing goal and soccer. I became a commercial fisherman. Sounds good. Made good money. Lifestyle was made for me at that point, right? All excess and full throttle. So that's when I first started trying to get a handle on my life. So I was about, geez, what I had been in my early 20s when I first tried to go to the AA program. For those of us that find recovery, there's usually some pretty embarrassing things that happen. You know, we wake up and go, oh my God, you know. And so I had one of those mornings, and then I decided to quit drinking and go to AA. But that, you know, 10 months later, it's my birthday, so I'm starting to think, well, I got a handle on this now. You know, I can have one. Next thing you know, I'm having two. Next thing you know, it's a couple days in a row. And so anyways, it's a predictable pattern that I realize now. So then I carried on with drinking again for another good stretch of time. And at about 30, by then I'd, you know, delved into various drugs as well. I was out herring fishing, and we had a week off, which is pretty rare in the middle of the season. And there was this First Nation gathering in BC place. And I knew my uncle and my aunt, Auntie Alice and Uncle Peter, were bringing one of our collection of masks down there to dance. Trying to find a hotel was very difficult because all the rooms were booked because there were so many people from out of town.
Right.
I remembered where my cousin Gino was. And so I went to his hotel, and sure enough, Gino and his partner Chardell were there, and Chardell's friend Esther was there. And that would be eventually my wife and ex-wife, and certainly remaining as the mother of my son. I went to University Administration of Aboriginal Government program at UVic, and that's where I first got the concepts of the struggle, if you want to call it that, for First Nations people in Canada. There was a writing component, there was a finance component, there was governance component, there was a legal component. It was a really amazing program. But it was geared for people that wanted to be in administration. But the things that really captured me were the governance and the law. I took part in the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People in the early 90s. And I went there, and there's a really amazing man. He's actually from one of the South Island tribes. And he said, you know what? He said, every time I lied on my couch drunk or stoned, the white man beat me again. He said, I wasn't doing anything positive for me, my family, my community, or my nation. And I remember thinking, wow, that really makes sense. So for a couple of years after that, every time I was on the couch drunk or stoned, I was like, he's right. I'm doing nothing. And I started to think about that as when I was actively involved in that kind of activity. It was like putting my life on pause. Because all I was doing was circles, just doing the same thing over and over again. After I finished at UVic, I wound up working up in Kingcome Inlet. And then I realized I had this epiphany of the meaning of this sign I saw in Royal Athletic Park after I graduated. Enthusiasm is what happens before reality sets in. So I worked there as the band manager, and I learned what a tough job it is. And A, because the government doesn't give any First Nation enough money to operate. They set requirements for First Nations that they must do, and then you don't have the resources to accomplish it.
How long were you there in that role?
1 year. not even quite a year. By the time I moved there, I'd been sober from alcohol for a year. But then without alcohol, it took away the best excuse or cover-up excuse for the drug of choice. Because so I just did that because I was drunk. And so then it was like face-to-face, no, I did that because it called. My life bottomed out. My wife at that time, one of my friends just got tired of carrying my lie. And so she expressed what I'd been up to. And so Esther was very disappointed because, of course, I said that I had been clean of that for years. So she left with my son, who was 2.
Ooh.
Yeah, so there I am in a very isolated community, looking in the living room and seeing the Mickey Mouse chair in the corner and realizing that my son was never going to be sitting in that chair again. And of course, so that's reliving another cycle, like what happened in my life, just a lot earlier for my son, right? And so, we all have different bottoms, and this was one that really, really got hold of me. What happened for me next is I talked to our A&D counselor in the community and said, I need help. And I really meant it. Like, I wasn't like the previous times I had just gotten, I had an episode that was embarrassing and I thought I should quit drinking or what have you. This was like a real deep bottom. And to see my child, who I had so much joy with, not there. I talked to the counselor, who's actually my cousin, Charlene. And then I decided, we talked about it, and so I wanted to find help. So I wanted to go to a treatment center. So I went to Round Lake Treatment Center. And
how long were you there for?
It was a 5-week men's program.
Did it work?
Yeah. But, one of my great uncle Paul, when I talked to him, and he heard me speaking at it, we were having discussion at dinner one time with a large group of family. And I said, Round Lake really did help me a lot. And he said, you're not giving yourself enough credit. I said, what do you mean? He says, did you make a very clear decision to change your life when you went up there? And I said, yeah. And he said, that's as important as what you learned. And I thought about that, but of course, with anybody in the recovery program, we know ego is a problem. So I like to, just focus on the tools that I picked up and what I learned there.
How old were you when you got out of the treatment center?
30.
Okay.
All right. So I've been sober and clean now 25 years. And to me, that's the greatest gift to life. when I walked away from the drug world and the alcohol world, and I realized that there is nothing, nothing that I can do that would be more important for my life than that. And of course, my son was just 2 years old, a little better than 2. And so really from the time that he's going to have cognitive memories, I was emotionally, physically, spiritually available to him his whole life. And that in itself is a breaking of a cycle. And like I mentioned, my dad was thrown out at 16. He tossed me out at 17. I helped my son move out at 19. So it only took 3 generations in one family, but we broke one cycle anyways, right? Or maybe, 2 perhaps. Once that occurred, I started to really open up to different opportunities. And so I realized being a band manager or a band administrator was not something that I wished to continue. It's a pretty awful job given the financial shortcomings at the outset. And then the whole, what you deal with in any First Nation community is the intergenerational trauma from residential school. And, I'm happy that, I'm sad that this is a reality for First Nations across the country, but I'm happy that society is learning about this now. It's a reality without question. I know the stories my mom taught me or told me about her life in residential school, and it explained a lot of the rough discipline that I experienced growing up. But we can only do what we learn, right? So when my dad tossed me, that's what happened to him, so that's what he learned, right? So that was his era. And helping my son move out was the coolest thing. I told him, I said, get your buddies together, get a U-Haul, come by, take whatever you want. And of course, he took the big TV, the surround sound, the couches, the tables, his bed, you know, the dresser. And
was this your TV, your surround sound?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, it was. My son's been on his own for all this time.
He lives here locally?
Here in Nanaimo, yeah.
What does he do?
Well, he's a chef by trade. I mean, he graduated from the culinary arts program. But now he did that for like 4 or 5 years. And now he decided on a new career path, and that's being a blackjack dealer in the casino.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, he's... I often joke and tell people, you know, my son is a lot like me. He's really shy and quiet and introverted.
Clearly.
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 Right.
Were you worried about, you know, alcoholism is one major factor of it is hereditary.
Mm-hmm.
There's a genetic component to it. Yeah. Were you concerned for your son?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've had long conversations with him, but when I was active in my alcoholism and addiction, I had some family members that were very condescending towards me. And I think, you know, they meant it in a loving way, but it certainly didn't come across that way. And of course, I think of a Perfect Circle song, Judith, where it says, "You're such an inspiration for the way I'll never choose to be." And that's how I view the knowledge I now have about recovery. I've done a lot. First as elected chief counselor,
What is a chief counselor?
It's the Indian Act.
Is it a counselor like we would use here in...
Like city council?
Like a city councilor?
Yeah.
Okay. It's not chief.
But it's chief. It's an elected chief counselor. I had great discussion with Bunker.
Is there... How many are there?
One.
Oh, so is it chief?
Yeah.
Okay.
But when you come from a culture that has active traditional leadership...
Yes.
We are always mindful to make that distinction. We had a do not consume order from Health Canada for our drinking water. And so we were getting, you know, those 5-gallon pails that fit on water coolers. That's what our water supply looked like. So we had, you know, hundreds and if not thousands of these things in our village.
And that was years, wasn't it, that boil water advisory?
No, it wasn't boil water. No, it was do not consume.
At all?
At all.
Good God.
Right? Canada, you know, yeah. In 2005.
Yeah.
But that's what I walked into, and that was one of the things that motivated me to become in leadership. 26 condemned homes with level 1 mold and a do not consume order. So there I was having a meeting, a community meeting. This is probably just weeks into being an elected chief. And I get a phone call from CBC, and they asked me if I'd be interested in doing an interview. I'm like, yeah, sure. When do you want to do it? We'll go live in 3 minutes. I was like, oh my gosh. And it ballooned into a national story. And so it created the right kind of pressures on the government to meaningfully deal with our situation. Of course, the sad thing is, why did it need to be a national story to build pressure to have drinking water and safe housing on reserve? And then after just a few years, was it 4 years, I think, as chief, an opportunity to become the secretary treasurer on the Union of BC Indian Chiefs came along, and I secured it. A year later, I ran for vice president, and I served 9 years as vice president. And that was the opening up of a whole lot of things to do regionally and nationally.
Were you in Nanaimo this time?
At that time, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, when I was chief for 14 years, I think it was about 5 years of that I was living here in Nanaimo.
Okay.
See, because I grew up here as a kid, moved away as a fisherman, came back, raised my son here.
Right.
And at that time, I moved up island thinking I needed to be closer to the community, only to realize a lot of the majority of the work I needed to do to help our community was located outside the community. And so then I moved down island to Campbell River. One of the things that, in addition to rebuilding the village, that we took on was fighting fish farms. Mm-hmm. And so I was a commercial fisherman for 12 years, and I remember how good it felt to be making money doing that. I remember how good it felt to be working on our food fish, realizing virtually every other First Nation in BC was doing the same thing. It was a real cool awakening for me about that food staple for our people. And of course, as I got involved in our culture, it became more of to realize it was such an integral piece to who we are. But we've wanted for decades independent science and monitoring, fought, never granted from industry or government. We have that now. I believe that when we finish the 3 or 4 years of science, we will be able to inform a new definition of sustainability for this industry in Canada.
How is running in the by-election different than running for election as chief counsel?
Oh, there's a remarkable difference. When I was vice president of the Union of BC Indigenous, we were part of something called the First Nation Leadership Council. So we'd meet with, you know, with then Premier Christy Clark and so on. And I said to her one time, I said, "You're lucky." I said, "You're not related to everybody that votes against you." And she looked at me, she was kind of surprised. I said, "Yeah, that's the way it is." And I thought about that more and more. And so the nature of First Nation politics is extremely personal because by and large, we're related in some manner to the people that vote for us or against us. And so there's no venue, like when the House is sitting, you're accountable. We're accountable 24/7.
Yeah.
You show up at a potlatch, a funeral, a wedding, or what have you, people are saying, "Hey, what about, you know?" And so.
And is that good for representative government or is that bad for representative government?
That's a good question. I know that it makes disappointments on both sides of the family, like your supporters and the ones that don't support initially, or ones that don't like a decision or like a decision. It becomes quite personal. You really become in tune with being clear on messaging. I took it a little too deep in terms of reporting out. Like, for me to be transparent and accountable, I want you to understand all that I'm doing. And my one cousin said to me, "Bob," he said, "you know, most people just want to know if the motor runs. You want to explain every piece and how it works." But it was my concept of accountability and transparency. I want you to understand what I'm doing, how it fits, where solutions can come about. It's because you wind up being called to task very often. And so we become the demands to really be knowledgeable on every topic. But, you know, for all the elected chiefs, and I don't think enough people understand or give credit or recognition or appreciation, is the diversity of knowledge. You have to know your stuff. And so...
Because your cousin's going to call you on it.
That's right.
Yeah. But is running for MP in Nanaimo not also quite personal? Nanaimo's a city, but it's a small
city. It's a small city, yes. Oh, yeah. And, you know, it is. But if I go to somebody's wedding here, not everybody's going to be there that voted. But when I go to a wedding or something at home, virtually everyone that's there are people that voted.
And how did you get to become the NDP candidate? Like, was that something you wanted to do? Was that something someone picked up the phone and called?
A number of years ago, one of the MPs that I worked with on wild salmon is Coquitlam NDP MP Finn Donnelly. And we had worked on a number of different things, including his private member's bill on closed containment. I had attended a number of different functions to do with the Fraser. So I got to know him. And during one of our occasions, I told him, I said, "You know what? I said, I've been NDP my whole life. The only time I've voted federally or provincially, it's NDP. And, you know, I told him, I said, "Did you know if the NDP are, you know, ever interested in a First Nation candidate, let me know." And so he sent me a message and wanted to have a phone call. So I phoned him. And of course, I told him that I grew up in Nanaimo. Like, this was my hometown. So he let me know that there was a nomination open in Nanaimo. And suggested or reminded me of our conversation and suggested that I consider it. And of course, by this time, I had decided not to run for chief and was wondering what might be next. And, you know, during that time, after I decided I wasn't going to run and told my family and the nation I wasn't running for re-election, I started to think about all the political abilities and understandings I've developed and how taking that into a purely technical consultation or being a consultant or something along those lines would actually be removing the skills that I have. And so when he mentioned about the running here, so I thought about it. And of course, Melissa, my honey, and I, we talked about it and good discussion over the weekend. And so we put my name in, filled in the forms, and went through the nomination process, and here I am. But it's been great fun. And, you know, of course, myself, as well as the party and the amazing team we had during the by-election, were disappointed in the outcome, just as anybody would be. But now here we are. We're, you know, we've got a great team together. We've begun our door knocking and being everywhere.
Is there anything you would do differently this time around that you from when you ran in the by-elections?
I was happy with how things went. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter what task you do. You look back and go, oh, I would have, maybe we could have done this or maybe we could have done that. But I think the one message I want voters in Nanaimo Ladysmith to know, because I understand much deeper, you know, the topic of environment, global warming. And the one thing that I possess is experience. What that means for here in my candidacy, I don't have a hope of developing an understanding. I've been eyeball deep in this for a very long time. And the one thing that I've maintained, and this is something that's not up for compromise, is honesty, integrity, and directness. And that's the one thing that it causes difficulty with some levels of government when you go in and be very direct and honest. But to that end, this is where I believe that the work that I've done with the federal and provincial governments is going to be a great benefit for Nanaimo Ladysmith.
What do you think your mom would say if she was seeing what you were doing now?
Well, she used to call me crazy, so that would be one of the compliments I would get.
That's a compliment? That would be a compliment from her?
Well, you know, like back when I was...
Well, thank you so much for this. You've been very generous with your time. I really appreciate it.
I remember a friend of mine in the 12-step program, he said, you know, ask me anything, just don't be shocked with the answer, because I'll be honest.
Bob Chamberlain is running for the New Democratic Party in Nanaimo Ladysmith. Next time on The Candidates.
On my 16th birthday, I was out door knocking with Tommy Douglas and going to events and spent my 16th birthday dinner with him. I knew that he was an important guy. I didn't know that he was as important as he was. At the time, I was thinking I should be hanging out with my girlfriend and my friends. 16th birthday, this guy's got great stories, but really...